Hi there. I'm Melissa Bowman for CKMS News on 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. Thanks for tuning in to today's Waterloo Region Weekly Roundup. In this episode, we'll hear updates on the Community Working Group on the vaccine rollout, the latest decisions at this month's Regional Council meeting on automated speed enforcement, social assistance changes, and the Community and Safety Well-being Plan. Kitchener had some committee meetings on March 8th that we'll take a closer look at, where they discussed the regional official plan review and how it could impact Kitchener specifically. And it seems it wouldn't be a Waterloo Region Weekly Roundup episode if we didn't discuss housing. So I'll share a bit from the Kitchener-Waterloo Community Foundation's recent Do More Good dialogue on the intersection of housing and race. In fact, let's start there. The KW Community Foundation has been hosting a series of panel discussions under the theme of Do More Good. They have hosted several that look at issues around housing. On February 25th, the panel spoke to how housing and race intersect. The event was moderated by KWCF CEO Elizabeth Heald, and the panelists were Clarence Kakajee, founder of Crow Shield Lodge, Carl Cottigan, CEO of Reception House Waterloo Region, MPP Laura May Lindo, and Tennille Warren, the Restorative Schools Service Coordinator at Community Justice Initiatives. Elizabeth started the conversation off with some stats.
Here are some of the stats that we found. 21% of the total visible minority population in Ontario are in core housing need, which is more than double the amount for people who are not a visible minority. In Waterloo Region, immigrants are 25% more likely to be in housing need than non-immigrants. Also in Waterloo Region, Indigenous people are 30% more likely to be in core housing need than non-Indigenous people. There are approximately 30,000 households that are precariously housed in Waterloo Region.
Tennille breaks down those numbers a bit and compares average rents locally with what a full-time worker earning minimum wage makes.
And the average rent for a bachelor unit in this region is $1,200. And if you look at basic living, livable wage, 40 hours a week, gross, you're making just under $2,000. Then you have to pay taxes on that. And then you have all the other expenses that you have to think about.
Tennille says that it's important that we collect data that will help us to actually address the issues at hand.
We're not collecting the data that we can use to make informed decisions. I'm looking at all of the housing strategies that are filled with innovation, but are lacking in targeted initiatives, targeted data collection. When I read a strategy that references human rights, but does not actually name that discrimination is embedded into the current housing practices, that's a red flag for me. That tells me that we're going to get a bunch of new buildings with the same problems.
Clarence also shares some concerns about what data is being collected and how.
In regards to the data, I'd really like to know how accurate it is. I know that with some of the Indigenous population, they really don't disclose their identity because of stigma and the way they will be treated or some of the barriers they might face.
Carl agrees that it is important to collect the right data, but it's also essential to use that data to affect actual change.
It is what you do with the data that is really helping us to move forward, because I think, well, we haven't collected data well, but even when we do that, we just kind of point out the fact that we've collected data. So what do you do with that information? How do you implement policies that respond to the inequities that exist?
Clarence also reminds attendees that while data can be helpful if collected and used appropriately, he also says that it's essential to ensure the right voices are at the table. The voices of those with lived experiences are too often excluded or silenced in these kinds of discussions.
And then we have inflation and all of these other contributing factors, but we still have this pocket of people that are struggling. And do those people that are struggling, do they have a voice? Is their voice being heard? And are those individuals being brought to the table? It seems like so many times throughout development and throughout growth, everybody is is actually stating what they think is within the best interests of those individuals that are struggling. But those individuals really don't have a voice and they're not sitting at the table. So when I think of some barriers, racism is one, housing stock is another, lack of funding. And then is the funding really funneled to the appropriate places when it does come?
Tennille raises concerns around whether what's being proposed and created is suitable and based on the needs of the community.
No, we have to disaggregate, but what happens after we disaggregate that data? How are we going to respond to those crises? Because right now we're talking about housing. We're seeing inclusionary zoning. We're seeing increased housing stock. But we're not seeing significant conversations around creating housing for the Indigenous community with their cultural representation. We're not seeing culturally literate and relevant and responsive policies being developed.
MPP Laura May Lindo built on that idea of suitability and how lack of access to the type of housing that a community or household needs can be used against them.
The ways in which the crisis gets used against us serves just to perpetuate the same cycle that Tennille's discussing. So for instance, suitability, having a lack of suitability of your housing has been a rationale to go into Indigenous and Black homes and take their children, right? And so that's why we see an overrepresentation of our kids in foster care.
Tennille also says that we must consider homelessness in conversations on affordable and precarious housing because the housing crisis is also a homelessness crisis.
We also have to consider homeless statistics in this process. And we know that 1 in 5 racialized families in Canada are living in poverty as compared to 1 in 20 of the alternative. And we also know that those same families are spending 50%, not 30%, but 50% or more of their income on housing. Racialized people, Black people, are making 76% of each dollar in their income. And Black women in particular are making 58 cents to the dollar. So we cannot separate income and poverty and homelessness, because that's literally what we have here. Being precariously housed means you're on the edge of homelessness. You're on the edge of street homelessness or shelter homelessness. But when you're living in unstable housing, overcrowded housing, where bodies are moving in and out, you're in a state of cyclical homelessness. So we have to realize that our housing crisis is also a homeless crisis.
Clarence concludes this panel with a reminder of the role of land for Indigenous people.
With the Indigenous view, land is shared and it's communal. It's not owned. It's actually borrowed to us. It's borrowed to us from the future generations that are in front of us. It's borrowed to us from our children. And we have to work hard to leave something behind for those next generations.
That concludes the discussion on housing and race hosted by the KW Community Foundation. However, their series is ongoing, and you can find all of their past panel discussions, as well as information about upcoming panels, at kwcf.ca/dialogues. Next, we'll hear some details from the region's community engagement group regarding the vaccine rollout. Meredith Radlin, a retired school principal and member of the community engagement group, makes some opening comments reminding attendees of the importance of an anti-racist framework with the rollout of the vaccine.
It has not been the practice to include marginalized and racialized communities in many of the major initiatives done by the region. So this community engagement group is an attempt to ensure that voices that are usually excluded from the discussion are invited to be heard. I am happy to be representing the Black community, which is very diverse, many cultures, many languages. And my role here really is to communicate, to work with the region to ensure that the messages that need to be heard about the vaccine rollout are communicated to the communities. Equitable delivery of the vaccine requires an anti-racist framework, and an anti-racist framework requires that the voices of racialized people be listened to, be heard, and be invited into the conversation.
Meredith states that vaccine hesitancy is a real concern in the Black community, and one of the things that causes distrust is the involvement of police in vaccine distribution. She then asks Chair Redman, why was it necessary for the police to be involved in the vaccine rollout? Chair Redman replies that the plan is incredibly complex and it needed someone with experience to take the lead. She says that Shirley Hilton has demonstrated that skill and experience. Chair Redman also notes that the team includes doctors, fire, pharmacists, IT experts, real estate agents, long-term care reps, GRT reps, and more. She concludes,
but it's absolutely important that we acknowledge that there is this history of a lack of trust, and there is history between the police and some communities, and we need to build confidence in the vaccine, and we need the community to help us do that. And I really do want to thank the Community Engagement Working Group for taking on this difficult task and for working with community leaders towards reconciliation with a goal to building trust in these communities and confidence in the vaccine.
Another working group member asked, what about those who are homeless or have no ID? Dr. Ball responded,
it can really be anything that confirms the identity of the client and that has a number or code assigned to it. So government issued, other ID, it doesn't really matter. The purpose is just to identify the client and make sure they are who they say they are, and also to locate the person in the provincial database in order to enter their second dose. So we are absolutely still able to immunize those without ID. We would provide them a unique number or a phrase that they can remember that they would be able to provide at the time of their second dose. And we are also, in addition, working with community organizations and healthcare providers who serve priority groups like those who are experiencing homelessness or, as you mentioned, the refugee population, to ensure there are plans in place to provide vaccinations in a way that would be accessible.
At this briefing, it was asked how the region will equitably distribute the vaccine to Black people if it's not collecting race-based data on immunization. Medical Officer of Health, Dr. Shuli Wang, said the region has been told to use a provincial immunization database that does not record race, but the province is working on changing that. The region is considering other ways to collect race-based immunization data and then merge it with the provincial system. A community engagement group member asked, what is being done to address the history of harm against the BIPOC population? Kelly Grindrod provided this response.
I think that's the first part is, in the speed of the rollout of the vaccine, we did see with these particular vaccinations, diverse populations being studied. But now the separate question is, how do we address these questions and concerns, very valid questions and concerns in specific populations? Co-production is a really important thing. So, you know, if there's someone like me who is working on producing these things, if there's organizations in the community that want to be working on adapting these things for their own communities, for example, you know, our documents could include an acknowledgement of past traumas and past atrocities and past crimes that could be embedded within that if a group wants to reach out to us to work on that. Similarly, a lot of the work that we've done could be translated into different languages based on what your populations need. Certainly, we're happy to work with groups on that.
And that wraps up the community engagement panel. Let's move now to some Region of Waterloo updates. This month, they discussed housing, automated speed enforcement, social assistance changes, and the Community Safety and Well-being Plan. Let's start with housing. Through the Waterloo Region Housing Master Plan, the creation of new units is underway through developments on Kings Court Drive and Wilson Ave. Both projects are at the functional design phase, with approximately 120 units in total between the two developments. Consultations with area municipalities, Waterloo Region housing tenants, and the public will form part of finalizing the designs and planning rationale. A revised budget will take place based on those conversations. Waterloo Regional Council approved grants to help develop two affordable and supportive housing projects for women and youth, which will help offset some cost of development charges for affordable housing providers. The recipients of those grants are One Roof and the YW Kitchener-Waterloo. Next, Regional Council discussed the Automated Speed Enforcement Plan, known as ASE. Staff mentioned that the province sets up most of the rules for ASE, including the requirement to post signage 3 months in advance. It's not easy to move cameras to new locations or even sometimes find locations that meet all of the province's criteria. Staff note that municipalities that have already implemented this have found that their systems can become overwhelmed in issuing tickets because so many people drive over the posted speed limits.
As other municipalities that have already started this have found that the number of tickets very quickly overwhelms their system because it is able to hand out, you drive past it at a speed that triggers it, and it will give you a ticket, and everyone that drives past will get a ticket. So the numbers can be quite large as people frequently don't follow the speed limit.
Kitchener Mayor Verbanovic says that this program needs to be ramped up as quickly as possible to ensure community safety.
Quite frankly, this is the single biggest issue that councillors hear about, speeding in neighborhoods. And so we really need to take a more comprehensive plan on this. Not as a moneymaker, because quite frankly, I'd be happiest if we had a whole bunch of these and they didn't issue many tickets. But to, in fact, make our community a safer community for everyone.
That discussion was for information only and no motion was voted on. Next, regional staff shared an update on changes happening with the social assistance system. The staff report states that the province's transformation plan will create an efficient, effective, and streamlined social services system that focuses on people, providing them with a range of services and supports to respond to their unique needs and address barriers to success so they can move toward employment and independence. By 2024, there will be a new social assistance system co-designed with municipalities that is sustainable and focuses on life stabilization and quality of life. Access to life stabilization and one-on-one support will no longer be determined by financial eligibility, but be available to people based on their need when they need it. Staff say that at one time, there were many barriers to accessing the supports people needed.
If we go back to prior to our integration work locally, clients would come to the municipality, to one of our offices, seeking services, whether they're social assistance or employment and income support, children's services, or housing. The client would have to go through multiple intakes. They would have to go to multiple service desks or even buildings to get these services. They would have to tell their story multiple times, and the individual services could not talk to one another because the confidentiality prohibitions in each of the pieces of legislation precluded case discussions from one program to the next.
Staff see some good reasons to be optimistic about these changes, though it's early on in discussions, and there are a number of areas that they feel they need more details on to better understand how these changes will impact the region's current processes. It sounds like there will be more information coming on these changes in the next few months. And the last update on the regional level is that staff are working on the Community and Safety Well-being Plan. It is the region's responsibility to develop this plan under the Police Services Act. Work on this plan began in 2019, but, like everything, was impacted by COVID. The new deadline has been extended to this July. The purpose of the plan is to encourage a collaborative and multi-sector approach to planning for community safety and well-being across the province. Staff say that the region is well positioned to create this plan, as we have already been doing a lot of that work through organizations such as Wellbeing Waterloo Region, Waterloo Region Crime Prevention Council, the Children and Youth Planning Table, and the Local Immigration Partnership. Again, more details to come as work progresses on this plan. So let's move over to Kitchener now, as they had some interesting discussions at their committee meetings this month. The first one I want to mention is the Regional Official Plan Review. This could be potentially confusing, so let me clarify. the region is doing a review of its official plan. That official plan is an important planning document that guides decisions related to growth, development, and community investment across the region. It outlines key planning ideas and policies, including the Countryside Line, the LRT, Central Transit Corridor, regional groundwater recharge area, and intensification targets, and was last completed in 2009. Those decisions are likely to impact the way things are done at the lower tier level of our cities and townships. So the City of Kitchener has been reviewing the review, I guess, to better understand any potential impacts the regional review will have on the city. One policy that keeps coming up is the Countryside Line, which is the boundary that has been set to limit sprawl and preserve our region's farmland. It seems that both city and regional councillors still see value in maintaining the Countryside Line, but it is definitely something I am keeping my eye on. Following the approval of the region's official plan, the city will be required to amend the city's official plan to conform to the regional official plan, also often referred to as the ROP. Kitchener's staff report says that the regional official plan, or ROP, can and should do more to support housing affordability, for example, by strengthening condominium conversion policies, encouraging rental replacement, and enabling the cities to implement inclusionary zoning. That report also states that tangible and implementable climate change policies are required to make a meaningful impact. For the first time, upper-tier official plans, such as the regions, are required to plan to the year 2051, that's much longer than usual, and plan for a minimum intensification target of 50%, up from the 40% established in the 2006 growth plan. These growth plan changes mean that several key policy directions that were historically determined at the city level will now be determined by the region through the ROP. The plan is based on forecasts that our regional population will reach 923,000 people and 470,000 jobs by 2051. As I mentioned, the region is using climate change as a lens to inform all components of the regional official plan review, and Kitchener staff are encouraged by this, though they do recommend that the ROP include a small set of impactful, tangible, and implementable climate policies. For example, it could direct that regional roads be developed as complete streets, prohibit adding additional vehicle lanes, and be more selective in taking land for road widenings through the development review process. The regional review also looks at the range and mix of housing needs, including affordable housing. Kitchener's staff report states that condominium conversion policies should be more stringent and that they should consider policies that encourage or require rental replacement for affordable units lost through redevelopment. Staff emphasize the impact these decisions will have on our community as we grow over the next 30 years, saying that there is a need for robust community engagement on these issues now.
It's really important as we think about the ROP that we have robust community engagement now, because a lot of the decisions that will happen at the ROP level will filter down to the city's official plan and have pretty significant implications on how we grow for the next 30 years. So robust engagement now is crucially important.
One delegation, Hal Yeager, spoke about the regional review at the Planning and Strategic Initiatives meeting regarding the need for affordable housing.
More construction will not lead to more affordable housing. Building more affordable housing will create more affordable housing. Affordable housing needs to be provided by bodies that seek to meet a need, not a profit. We need the region and upper levels of government to get back in the business of social housing, as was done until 1993, and as other countries tackling this challenge are doing.
The next issue Kitchener Council discussed at this meeting was housing in the Lower Doon area. The city hired a consultant company to do a review of the issues in this area related to the large student population and concerns around appropriate housing and regulations in the area. The consultant's report included 23 recommendations, such as the need for higher density and mixed-use housing in the Homer Watson area, permitting accessory dwelling units, implementing additional sidewalks, and allowing lodging houses. That last point on lodging houses resulted in a larger discussion on the issue, including the option for licensing lodging houses rather than relying on zoning.
What we will have noted is that not permitting them has not stop them from proliferating in this neighborhood. And there's a couple of reasons why that has happened, notwithstanding the zoning bylaw. And that is that the zoning bylaw, which is under the Planning Act, may not be the best tool to try and manage the lodging house issue. Zoning bylaws are very good at regulating housing type and built form and talking about the scale of buildings and their location on a lot. They can define parking requirements and so on. What they cannot do is you cannot use the zoning bylaw to regulate the occupancy of a dwelling, and you cannot regulate whether it's owned or rented.
As noted in the Waterloo Region Record, this is a complicated issue with plenty of landlords offering safe housing, but others who are not. This has led to city bylaw officers patrolling the area at least 3 days a week while parking enforcement is there daily. The City of Waterloo has had a rental housing licensing bylaw since 2011. It allows for a maximum of 4 bedrooms and owners must cut the grass, clean up garbage, and have a plan for parking and snow removal. Currently, Kitchener doesn't allow for lodging houses or duplexes in the Lower Dune area, but that doesn't mean that they aren't there. The consultant's report listed concerns as some of these rental units being unsafe for students, the poor maintenance of some rental homes, and the existence of some, quote, unethical and greedy landlords, end quote, threatening students who complain about their living conditions. One delegation spoke to this issue, Mary Cunningham, who said that there's just simply too many students in the area.
The classic problems we have with students here and in every other college or university town in Ontario are exacerbated by too many students. So unless we do something about numbers and demographics in Lower Dune, things are going to get worse, not better. And I know you can't do anything about demographics. We have to try. This takes big thinking, not staying on course. There must be something different you can do, something new and different.
The report also suggested the college play a more active role in managing student rentals and prepare a code of conduct and good neighbor guide for students living off campus. Ward 2 Councillor Dave Schneider says that it is pertinent for the college to play a bigger role in this issue.
Really happy to see that in the recommendations that the college needs to be more involved. I really, really hope this can happen because in the past, they don't seem to want to engage and be part of discussions at all. I think it's unbelievable that they don't worry that their students, some of them, are living in unsafe, illegal accommodations.
Councillors voted in support of this, but it still requires final council approval later this month. And just a quick update on the last issue discussed at that committee meeting. Polo Corp had a proposed development for Mill Street that included a variety of heights from 3-story townhomes up to a 12-story tower. We heard at the February meeting that the developer was in discussions with a neighborhood working group to find a plan with which all working group members were content. Polo Corp has decided not to move forward with that development at this time and is instead proposing a less dense form of residential development to include a combination of 3- and 4-story stacked townhomes and back-to-back townhomes. Staff anticipate being in a position to present the revised application and associated planning recommendation by April or June of this year. And that concludes this episode of the Weekly Roundup, a program that is part of the Local Journalism Initiative Grant Program and is funded by the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Government of Canada, and the CKMS Newsroom. You can find out more about that initiative as well as all of the CKMS programming at Radio Waterloo. Also, feel free to continue this conversation. You can find me on Twitter at M2Bowman. Thanks for listening.